Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient, and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees, so I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in 2 orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply. How are you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing good, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing fine. A quick shout out to Oscar. I got seen out in public and somebody recognized me. Doesn't happen very often.
What, are you wearing a hat? What's going on?
I'm incognito most of the time.
Happy birthday to Patricia, who also helped us out with some tickets.
The Panic Fest tickets. Very kind of you, because we absolutely needed them at the last minute. So you saved the day.
I also want to say thank you to everyone who's written in recently. I don't know what's going on, but there's been just a bunch of people writing in saying how much they love the show and sending in suggestions. I don't really send emails out to people. I did send one out to a musician I really liked the other day. And I could tell from the message I got back that he's just like we are. You know, you get these really nice emails in, and I don't know, it just lifts you up a little bit, especially if you've had a rough day. And Justin and I, we've been so busy this week. It's kind of been a rough week, even though mood-wise, I feel pretty good.
Yeah. And this case that we're going to do tonight, I feel like we almost bit off more than we could chew. I was reading through it and thinking, really? that's a lot to talk about. Should this be like a multi-parter?
Yeah, for me, this was emotionally more than I could chew, because you know how there are people that have something about them that bothers you? This guy has many things about him that bother me.
Yeah, I'm not one for the death penalty, but this guy, he might sway a few people. So what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Tonight, we're back on a Kansas City case, and this one involves a man by the name of John Edward Robinson, who was a serial killer who operated around the Kansas City area. He actually operated on both sides of the line.
For anyone that doesn't know, Kansas City has State Line Road that goes down the middle, so half of the city's in Missouri, and the other half is in Kansas.
John Edward Robinson was born on December 27, 1943, in Cicero, Illinois. He was the third child of 5. His father was a drinker, and I believe this was because he worked a lot of hours, and he coped by drinking. Now, his mother, according to John, was a bit of a disciplinarian, but the way I look at it is she was basically raising 5 children on her own, so I kind of question this. She had 3 boys and 2 girls. And I can only imagine that it would take a lot of work to keep them in line. And one of the examples given by John was that he had failed out of math. And so for an entire summer, she made him sit and work on math in order to learn it. Now, while his dad was a drinker and probably didn't spend enough time with his kids, he was very much into scouting. And I would say scouting is an American tradition, right, Justin? I mean, it's taken very seriously in this country.
Oh, yeah. In fact, if you join the military and you have, like, if you were in the scouts, you join the military a rank up.
I would say that's pretty serious. So that's how he spent time with his dad. And I think, just like anyone else, he valued that time. At age 13, John Robinson was a patrol leader with 20 merit badges. And in the fall of 1957, he earned his Eagle Scout badge and was enrolled in Quigley Preparatory Seminary in Chicago. He's living in the Chicago area, and he already has it in his head that he wants to become a priest. I'm pausing because I find this quite shocking given what I know about him.
Yeah, it's just wait for it.
Quigley was a private school for boys who were going to become priests, but Robinson drops out after about a year because of disciplinary issues, and in addition, his grades had declined over time there. So I think maybe his heart fell out of it early on, and just like anything else, his parents are probably telling him, hey, you signed up for this, but that's just a guess. Mm-hmm. Now, it seems he was more interested in being involved with low-level criminals for money, because he started hooking up with people who would say, hey, go do me this favor, run this over there for me, and then they'd throw him a little bit of money. And he was doing that. So he was basically doing, what would you say, odds and ends for low-level criminals.
Kind of, yeah.
He's like an errand boy.
Yeah, yeah. He was not in with the right group or gang.
Speaking of gangs, just weeks after he became an Eagle Scout, he was flown to England to be a part of a gang show that was to be performed in front of the Queen of England and celebrities, which is kind of a big deal, wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah. I mean, we have celebrities, we have the upper echelons of society all here, and he's getting to, you know, rub elbows with them or whatever.
Yeah, well, and he did. So a gang show is basically a variety show or a musical that's put on by the scouts, and it started in 1932 and continues to this day. While he's at the gang show, he gets to meet the Queen, and he also gets to meet Judy Garland.
Which... you posted the photo of him and Judy on our Facebook as the episode hint, you know, Tuesday hint day. And I was looking at it and I was thinking, am I researching the wrong case? What am I doing here? It, like, totally threw me off.
Yeah, some people got it right. And then other people were like, wait a minute, what's Judy Garland and her son Joey doing? Is this a case?
Yeah.
John Edward Robinson meeting Judy Garland. And when he meets her, he says, we Americans got to stick together. And she said, you're right. And she gave him a kiss, you know, like on the temple or something. And that's the picture you see because they met. And according to the people that met him, they say he was pretty charming.
And I just don't want to gloss over this. People were guessing this correctly. Our fans and our listeners, wow. Half the time Aaron puts hints out and I don't get them. You know, you think that we're like the true crime gurus, but you guys, you nail it out of the park.
So, of course, Judy Garland was known for her role as Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. But really, over time, she was more of a singer. He also got to meet Gracie Fields, who was a big actress at the time. And she even found him charming and talked with him about his desire to become a priest. But as I said, as time goes on, he really doesn't want to become a priest. And I'm not even sure how he got started on that path.
So far, though, he's had a pretty eventful and successful childhood. I'm not hearing anything horrible going on here.
Yeah, I mean, you could say his dad was a bit rough and maybe wasn't there enough for him. And maybe he felt his mother was too strict, but I already said she had five kids to handle all on her own, basically. So, yeah, there's nothing really that stands out here that I could find. In 1961, he enrolled at Morton Junior College in Cicero, his hometown. He wanted to become an X-ray technician, but after 2 years, he drops out of the school. And I think as we go on, you'll find that with John Robinson, it's not about acquiring the skills. It's about selling the idea of what you want people to believe you are.
And he doesn't follow through with a lot of things, especially legit careers.
In 1964, after, I guess you could say, a brief dating period, he married Nancy Jo Lynch in Chicago, and then soon after moved to Kansas City, and he got a job working for Dr. Wallace Graham, who had been President Harry Truman's personal doctor and friend. John's hired as a lab tech, but of course he didn't finish school, and he really doesn't know what he's doing. And some of the people there pick up on this, and they're like, wait a minute. When John got there, he had all this evidence of his education, of how well-skilled he was, and how he'd be very beneficial if they hired him. But his actions aren't speaking as loud as his paperwork, so there's a question there. Wallace Graham's son starts looking into things, and he does not believe John Robinson. He thinks he's a liar. He discovers that John's been embezzling money from his dad, from Dr. Wallace Graham. And it's to the tune of about $33,000.
I think there's just some people that can smell the BS, and he could see through John's BS.
Well, he looks into it, and he discovers that John had been using the doctor's signature stamp to sign checks over to himself, and was able to get some patients over time to pay him in cash, which of course he just pockets. He's arrested, charged, and tried, but he gets just 3 years probation.
Slap on the wrist. I know people that have shoplifted from Walmart and got like 5 years probation. So, yeah.
And I think later on we'll tell you why we think this is the way it is with John Robinson. But Wallace, or Dr. Graham's son, he says really it's not $33,000. He thinks it was actually six times that amount.
That's all they could really trace back through the paperwork and the forged documents.
John then goes on to work for a TV rental business, and he steals from that company as well. In 1970, he's hired, but then later fired, from Mobil Oil Corporation for stealing 6,200 postage stamps, which even then wasn't a lot of money. But this highlights just what one person who knew him said, which was, there's no scam that was too small for John Robinson.
He's sounding like a con man, a con artist. All he's doing is stealing. It's just larceny, theft, all over the place. Embezzlement, you name it.
And I had said earlier about how John's dad may not have been there enough for his kids. Well, John and Nancy had four children over about a six-year period. They started with John Jr. in 65, Kimberly in 67, and then had fraternal twins, Chris and Christine, in 1971. And from all accounts, John Robinson was there for his kids. If they had practice, or if they were putting on a performance in band, whatever it was, he tried to go to a lot of these events. And he was even continuing to work in scouting.
Yeah, and he joined his local church. He was a scout master. He was very much involved in his children's lives and involved with the community.
In 1970, he had moved back to Chicago with his family and worked for Illinois R.B. Jones, which was a financial services company. It's there that he embezzled $5,600 and, after being caught, was fined. With the money loaned from his father, John pays that money back, and the case against him was dropped. But he's not free and clear because he's later arrested because he had broken his probation.
I just want people to understand that it is a slap on the wrist for serious crimes, but they do and can nail you to the wall if you mess up or misstep at all. So I'm glad that they're following up with him and record checking him.
His probation officer firmly believed that John would be reformed because he did some jail time and had some counseling. And, of course, because he had moved to Chicago, the probation officer ordered him to move back to Kansas. And so he did. In 1973, John Robinson creates a fake business named Professional Services Association Incorporated, which was presented as a financial consulting firm. And it's a scam. The scam.
Wait. He's a consultant who takes your money. I don't think this is a scam, right? This is normal.
Well, we'll go through this. His scam was targeting doctors, and he forged letters to drum up business and to sell fake stock in his company. But one of the people that he scammed was friends with Ewing Kaufman, who anybody in the Kansas City area knows the name Kaufman. Kansas City Royals.
Kaufman Stadium.
That's right. Robinson had used a forged letter to trick people into believing that Kaufman was aggressively trying to acquire his business, which of course would make buying the stock now, before the acquisition, all the more attractive. So this man who got scammed calls Kaufman up and tells him about the letter he'd read. And Kaufman, of course, gets pretty ticked off. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission is notified. And in December of 1975, Robinson was indicted on 4 counts of securities and mail fraud. He pleaded no contest to the charges, was fined $2,500, and given 3 years probation.
Oh my gosh. Crime does pay, apparently.
Well, I think, you know, I wonder if it's his probation officer was talking about how, yeah, I think he's going to be a better man now. Is this just wishful thinking?
I wish that when somebody's stolen money or embezzled anything, whatever it may be, that they have to pay back the victim. I don't want to see a $2,500 fine to the government or anything like that. I want to see restitution paid, and I'm not seeing it here. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's not every time out, that's for sure. His scams continued unabated, really. The next thing he goes to is he starts selling these indoor fruit and vegetable growing kits named HydroGrow. And he had these glossy brochures printed up, and then he sought out people to invest in it. And all the while, he's continuing to be involved with his kids' activities and participating in scouting. In a funny moment, one woman who listened to his sales pitch on HydroGrow for a little bit decided it was just too expensive for her. And John became really angry. And this is something that not everyone would see about John. It just depends on what the situation was. But he could become very, very irate. And he called her small potatoes.
Yeah.
How dare you not fall for my scam?
Yeah.
In 1980, John Robinson became the personnel manager for Guy's Foods, which was owned by Borden. Now, when the company started selling off its Ford Econoline van fleet, Robinson sold a few dozen or so and just kept the money. And the owner's nephew caught on to this, and after reviewing the business records, also found that Robinson had created fake or phantom employees whose paychecks were just going to him. So John was ordered to pay $41,000 in restitution and serve 60 days in jail. He was also hit with 5 years of probation. Now, the reason why this all sounds really light is because Robinson only pleaded guilty to stealing a $6,000 check.
At least he had to pay restitution, but still, it's a slap on the wrist. And the fact that he has multiple offenses now, he's building up a record. I'd say, if this was the three strikes, you're out kind of rule, he's already hit his three strike.
The next person he runs afoul of is his wife, Nancy. Because of his scams with Guy's Foods, a.k.a. Borden, it came to light that John had been using some of his ill-gotten money to rent an apartment in Olathe, Kansas, where he would meet women for sex. And a couple of them worked for Borden. And his wife, Nancy, briefly considered divorcing him, but in the end decided not to. But I don't know if it's because he talked to her and she decided to give him another chance, or if she just feared him.
It's a good question, because he was very manipulative and charming. So did he smooth things over, or did he intimidate her? That's the whole thing. And he could go either way with him. Flip a coin.
Yeah, it's tough to say. I do know that from people that saw him interact with his kids in public, if it was the grocery store or wherever it was, they said he was very commanding. And so he seemed to be more of the dominant type. So I don't know if he'd really smooth things over that way with his wife. Just my opinion. But I think with his type of personality, probably just let her know that that wasn't going to happen. That's just my own gut instinct on this. So he serves a brief stint in jail in 82, and he starts asking his female neighbors for sexual favors. And after groping a woman in his neighborhood, he had to flee in his vehicle to escape her very large and angry husband. And witnesses said that if he had managed to catch up to John, he probably would have torn off his head.
But again, this is one of those things where if you report it, at least there's record of it. I'm not going to say that anything's going to be done. I know that it doesn't mean that he's going away, but anytime somebody's behaving this way, we have to report it to start a paper trail. And it's just more that can be used against them later.
He also joined the International Council of Masters, which was a secret sadomasochism cult. And he became a slave master and was apparently involved in torturing people and possibly raping them.
Yeah, this is not a regular BDSM scene that he's in. This is really for him to dominate and torture people. So in the regular BDSM scene, it's very consensual. Everyone's in agreement. Everybody knows or has to trust the other person. He's using this as an excuse or a cover to actually sexually assault people. It just doesn't add up. And within the scene, he is now known and people are talking about him and avoiding him.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements, I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better. Notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
In the summer of 1982, John Robinson founded Equiplus, which was a consulting firm meant to help businesses work better. Well, his wallet worked better, but whatever. One of the first businesses he tried to scam was Online Computers, which was started by a father and son, Scott and Bob Davis, who were his neighbors. Now, they agreed to provide computers for Equiplus and pay him to turn their business around because it wasn't doing very well. And I think part of that was because at that time, the benefit of computers wasn't as understood as it is in the modern age, is what I'd call it. Nowadays, we understand how useful they are. But back then, they didn't even have the internet running. It just wasn't as understood. He arranged for a business loan to help the company. But the loan wasn't from a bank. And when these two guys went with John to go sign paperwork to get this money approved, they didn't go to an office. They went to a building that looked like it had recently been moved into and previous to that was abandoned and in pretty rough shape.
So this is just another facade, another lie.
that they're walking into.
Yeah, in fact, there are hints that this might have been sort of a low-level mob kind of deal, because one of these guys looked into a room while the secretary walked away and saw an Italian flag. But it's really, we're not really sure what was going on there, but it's scam, scam, scam. So anyway, this so-called bank or loan company, whatever it ended up being, goes under, is what happens somehow.
They always do.
And they don't get their money. So they don't pay John anything, but he's really upset. So he forged some documents that showed that online computers had signed an agreement to pay Robinson $250,000 no matter what happened with their business, which is crazy because in the 1980s, what's $250,000?
That's about over half a million.
It's serious money. And
this is a small mom, you know, dad and son computer business who are trying to hire a consultant for hundreds of dollars to turn over and possibly make a few more $100, but a $250,000. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I think it worked. I think the actual original agreement was they were willing to pay him $1,000 a month or something like that, but nowhere near this $250,000, but that doesn't work out. So what happens is they call him out on his BS and they say, give up the original documents. And of course he doesn't have original documents. So then he tries threatening the father and the son, and that doesn't work either. And I got the sense reading about it that they weren't intimidated because they were too angry. And yeah, you know how that works. Sometimes someone's so angry, they don't care what is in front of them. They're just going to let you know how angry they are.
I do that.
In 1984, John Robinson changes tactics a little bit, and he creates Equi2, which absorbed EquiPlus and became more of a philanthropic venture, or at least that's what he wanted people to think it was.
This is about the time when I start to get really disgusted with this man.
October 23rd, 1984, Paula Godfrey, a 19-year-old figure skater and recent graduate of Olathe North High School, answered an ad in the Kansas City Star for clerical training and an office job. So she's ready to get to work post-high school. She was supposed to have returned to her family by October 30th or so, but she never came back. And on September 1st, Diane Godfrey, her mother, goes to the Equi2 office looking for her daughter. And there, the man at the office says, well, she hasn't been in touch with us since I sent her to Texas for training. So the police are notified. And days later, Paula's parents received a letter in what appeared to be her handwriting. So an update, right? Mm. In the letter, Paula explained that she needed to get her head on straight before joining the family again, before sitting down with them. And her parents, they didn't buy it. Now, so often when you're following a true crime story, you're always waiting for that moment where someone gets so upset that they'll take the law into their own hands, right?
So far, this entire story, I've been waiting for someone to take the law into their own hands. But yeah. So this family, their daughter is missing. They've reported it, but now they've got this letter, and it doesn't seem to be a legitimate letter from their daughter. But the police, it seems to pacify the law enforcement investigation of, well, you know, she's an adult. She doesn't have to come home.
Her father, Bill, gets a gun and visited Robinson at his office. He pointed the gun at his face and he demanded that Robinson make sure that Paula call her parents within 3 days or he would kill him. And this is with John there and I guess the woman who was his secretary. So there's a witness seeing this man pointing a gun at her boss. John had already said he didn't know where Paula was. He's like, she went to Texas and I haven't talked to her since. I don't know where she is. But with a gun in his face, now he's saying, I will let her know. She'll call you. Diane, Bill's wife, she doesn't want him to solve his problems with a gun. And so she urges him to get rid of the gun and to just trust in the police. Let the police handle this. I don't want you escalating this. I don't want anything to happen to you. So he does this, she asks, and he doesn't go after John anymore. Now, two more letters arrived in the mail, both supposedly from Paula, and she's talking about her life at the moment, and she's hanging out with a friend named Jackie. The Overland Park Police Department, who has since decided, yeah, we're going to look into this, they also received a letter. But that letter has Paula explaining to them that she's residing in Western Kansas, and she just doesn't want to see her parents right now. So they're thinking about it. She's 19 years old. This letter appears to have her handwriting on it, so they suspend the investigation.
She's an adult. That's the whole deal.
They're trusting that these letters are from her.
Exactly. And they don't know any better. And of course, the parents are going to say, these aren't our daughter's words, because they're the parents. They care. But who are they supposed to believe at this point? And yeah, they can't make contact because it's a letter. No return address.
Toward the end of 1984, John Robinson decided to take action to help his brother out. His brother and his wife, Don and Helen, had been unable to conceive a child. And John told them, hey, I have some contacts in the adoption world, and I bet I can get you a baby. And they'd already tried the adoption thing, and it just didn't work out for them. They couldn't get a baby. So here it is. They have his brother John's telling them, hey, I can get you a baby.
The adoption process, anyone that's been through it, it's very costly and time consuming. So I understand why they gave up.
And probably not guaranteed to work either.
No, you could spend $50,000 in legal fees and be out, not have a child.
In December of 1984, John Osborne, which is really John Robinson, visited Truman Medical Center. And he met with social workers there to explain a program that he and other Kansas businessmen had started. Ha ha. He also told them that he was on the board of directors for a bank. The program was named Kansas City Outreach, and he said it was affiliated with the Presbyterian Church in Stanley, Kansas. And the program provided job training and places to live for unwed single mothers and their babies. And in a short amount of time, he had three different mothers referred to him. So by early January, there were two young mothers living together in an apartment on Troost. There was a woman named Lisa Stacy who was staying at a hotel with her newborn. And of course, both these living arrangements were provided by this John Osborne. Lisa Stacy had had a brief relationship and then a brief marriage to Carl Stacy. Early in 84, they were kind of dating, but not exclusively. And then later in the year, she's pregnant and they decide to get married in August. But less than 4 months after that, they really have a falling out. And he decides to reenlist in the Navy. He wants to get away. While the marriage was over, she did have support. Carl's family stayed in touch with her and remained a part of her and her daughter Tiffany Lynn's lives. There was also a man named John Osborne who offered her a place to stay, as I said, and was going to help her with employment. But on January 8th, she decided to stay at Carl's sister Kathy's house. And John's trying to reach her at the hotel, but he can't find her. And so he leaves a message, please have her call me. Well, she finds out about that and gives him a call. And he says, I will visit you at Kathy's house the next day and I'll pick you and Tiffany Lynn up. And he does. Kathy meets this guy for the first time, and she says later that her first instinct is she fears this man. He came in and he was not nice. He didn't want to spend any time. He didn't want to exchange any pleasantries. He wanted Lisa and her baby out the door as fast as they could go. And that's all he wanted. He didn't care about anything else. Not even a little pleasantry like, how are you doing tonight? Nothing.
I mean, the less time he spends with them, the less they'll be able to identify him, I think.
I don't know what it was, but that could be it, because he just didn't want to spend any time there. That night, Betty, who is Kathy's mother and Lisa's mother-in-law, got a frightening call from Lisa. She can hear Lisa crying, and Lisa's telling her, she says that they have told her that Betty is working to have the baby removed from her because she was an unfit mother. Despite Betty's assurances otherwise, Lisa seemed sold on this idea. And she also said that they wanted me to sign 4 sheets of blank paper. Betty told her not to sign anything. She said, don't sign nothing. John Osborne, a.k.a. John Robinson, was actually telling Lisa that she needed to sign the sheets so that he could write to her family and update them on her whereabouts, as she would be too busy to let them know what she was up to.
What? I don't even understand that lie, because he tells multiple women this. Sign your name on this blank sheet of paper so we can write them letters letting them know you're okay. Like, if anyone ever tells you to sign something, a blank piece of paper, don't do it, ever. He's in control. These women have gone to him for a job. They're getting paid. They're getting taken care of. So they're very complicit with some of these lesser demands. But here you see a total sociopath running a family against each other. And this woman now thinks that her own mother is trying to get her child taken from her.
And we also don't know if she's acting under fear, because she could feel threatened, and maybe that's why she's saying and doing these things. Now, the last words that Betty heard before the call was disconnected were, "Here they come." And then the call was disconnected. That was on the night of January 9th. On January 10th, Don and Helen Robinson fly in from Chicago to pick up their adopted child, because John had told them, "I've got a baby here for you, and her name is Tiffany." Don and Helen look over documents that have signatures from lawyers, whatever, and everything looks legitimate. In total, between two payments, they paid a total of $5,500 for this adoption. They changed the daughter's name and they named her Heather, because it was Tiffany Lynn. They didn't know anything about where this girl had come from, because all John had told them is that this young woman had gotten pregnant, then had decided to give up her baby, but a social worker had talked her out of it. But then she really changed her mind again, really wanted to have the baby go elsewhere. And so she left the baby at a women's shelter, then checked into a hotel room and took her own life. So that's all that Don and Helen knew about it. So they kept the girl's middle name, which was Lynn.
But that whole story's BS. None of it happened.
Right. Really, what this comes down to is, so John had met up with Lisa Stacy and her daughter. Suddenly, Lisa disappears. I mean, the last we know of her, she called her mother-in-law. That's the last we know of her, because when a call is placed next day to try and track her down, they said that John Robinson, who had been paying for the room, not John Osborne, as he had been telling everybody, John Robinson had paid for the room and Lisa and her baby had checked out. And so even the hotel didn't know where they were. They just said, well, they're gone. They're not here anymore. And then you have John Robinson's brother and his wife heading back to Chicago with their new baby daughter. So I think we can do the math here.
He's murdered a woman, kidnapped her child, and sold the child under the guise of, you're adopting this child, to his own brother, and charged them over $5,000. This is disgusting.
In 1987, John Robinson hired 27-year-old Catherine Clampett, promising extensive travel and new clothes. So here's a great offer. You know, I'm going to pay for you to travel and go to different countries, and I'll buy you clothes. We're going to have you mingle with people. Catherine left her child with her parents in Texas to travel to Kansas City. She disappeared in June of 1987 and has not been seen since.
Now, these families are reporting their daughters missing. And especially with this case, she left her own daughter back with her parents, and then she just disappears. Again, it's not adding up, but law enforcement doesn't have much to go on, because either A, they don't know where they went and that they're actually going to John Robinson's place of business, or they go there and John has all the answers for them. He has letters or stories of boyfriends and whatnot, and he doesn't know where these women have gone.
And also, John Robinson isn't always John Robinson. I mean, he had a bunch of aliases: JT, Jim Turner, John Davison, Don Davis, John Osborne, Sandy, Bill Summers, and JR. Sometimes people would show up at his office and he would be someone else. And again, he would have the answers. He would say, oh, don't worry about it. In fact, a parole officer was actually talking to him about Lisa Stacy. This is when he was getting into some legal trouble again. He said, oh, by the way, Lisa's been found, so you don't have to worry about her. He gave the name of a woman who Lisa had babysat for. That woman, after a while, because she didn't give it up right away, after a while she admitted that John had asked her to lie for him. So they know there's something really wrong there. But again, you can have the idea that something happened, but you need proof. And right now, there just really isn't any proof. They can follow these leads, and he looks shady as hell, but they don't have anything concrete. But what they do have is these arrests that they can make for fraud. You know, he's continuing to pull scams, and he's continuing to be arrested. So between 1987 and 1993, in both Kansas and Missouri, he gets arrested and incarcerated on multiple fraud convictions. And it's while he's incarcerated in Missouri that he meets a woman.
A 49-year-old librarian, Beverly Bonner. When he was released, she divorced her husband and decided to move in with John. So he must have been very charming in prison. Once she's moved in with him, she is not heard from again. Her alimony checks were rerouted to a P.O. box by her mother. They would continue to be cashed long after her disappearance. Again, this is a con. Everything this man does is a lie. And he's doing it for the thrill, he's doing it for the money, he's doing it for self-preservation, I guess. I don't know. But anytime any of these women have any sort of Social Security or alimony, he finds a way to have those checks rerouted to him.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know, so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
Now, as we know, in the early 90s, the internet was available for everyone, or anyone who could afford it. And Robinson took his interest in BDSM and decided to network out. His screen name was Slave Master. He wanted to find women who enjoyed the submissive role during the relationship, really. And so the internet gave him the ability to hook up with people all over the country. And in 1994, he met 45-year-old Sheila Faith. He portrayed himself as a wealthy businessman, and I know that when he would put his picture out there, he had taken pictures of himself to where he looked like he was a dude rancher, so he'd wear like a cowboy hat. He looked real friendly, big smile. Well, he offered Sheila a job, and he offered to pay for her 15-year-old daughter, Debbie's, medical expenses, since Debbie had spina bifida. And the two women moved to Kansas City from Fullerton, California, and both of them disappeared. Although Sheila's pension checks continued to be cashed by Robinson for 7 more years.
So this woman who has recently separated from her husband is trying to take care of her 15-year-old disabled daughter and is looking for any kind of help, moves across country and disappears immediately.
Again, it's like that rose-colored glasses thing where some of these people, they can't believe how lucky they are. I can't believe this guy is willing to help me out like this. when people have asked him, you know, why are you trying to help people out? He said, it just feels good. I want to help people.
And this is the sad part about this is there are many grassroots organizations, whether they be church organizations or just community organizations that do reach out to battered women, single mothers, what have you. And a lot of these places, they're not in a nice business building. They're just people like you and me that are trying to make a difference. Somebody like John Robinson makes us all uneasy because now we don't trust any of these real legit businesses that are trying to help people, these actual philanthropists that are trying to make a difference in the world. But here we have multiple women that have gone to him for help and assistance and now have never been seen or heard of again.
So John Robinson, the internet is giving his more disturbing aspects an outlet, and he's becoming more well known in BDSM chat rooms. In 1999, he met 21-year-old Izabella Lewicka, who was a Polish immigrant. So apologies if I mispronounce the last name. She was living in Indiana, and he offered her a job and a bondage relationship. So she moved to Kansas City. Robinson's still married, but he gave her an engagement ring and brought her to the county registrar to get a marriage license. He's telling her, I want to marry you. Now, he never picked up the marriage license, but Izabella was telling her parents and everyone else that she'd gotten married, though she never told them what her last name was going to be. So it's unclear just how much she believed that they were going to be married or were married or not, but she was in a relationship with him. And Robinson, getting involved in this BDSM relationship, had her sign a 115-item contract that gave him full control over pretty much every aspect of her life, including her bank accounts. And this is something that would be a pattern with him. He would want these women to give up everything they had to him. Everything. Full control. Sometime during the summer of 1999, she disappeared. Robinson told an employee of his that she had gotten caught with marijuana and been deported back to Poland.
So her parents know she's missing. They drive all the way from Indiana to Kansas City to try to find where their daughter is, but all they can do is find a P.O. box. And when they ask the people there, hey, who does this belong to? Well, of course, P.O. boxes are anonymous and the man running the shop won't give a name up. So her parents come up short and they have to return to Indiana without their daughter.
About the same time that Izabella disappeared, a 28-year-old licensed practicing nurse named Suzette Troughton moved to Kansas from Michigan. And she was told by John that she would be his submissive sex slave and the two would travel the world together. And I guess this sounded good to her. Suzette's mother received numerous typewritten letters from her daughter, all postmarked in Kansas City, that were supposedly mailed from abroad. So, I mean, that just seems stupid to me. All the letters were mistake-free, so no typos, no misspellings, which, you know, her mother said, no, Suzette makes errors all the time. She can't write like that. Robinson claimed that Suzette stole money from him and then ran away with an acquaintance of hers. Again, it's out of his hands because she just disappeared on her own. I had nothing to do with it.
Suzette had two Pekingese dogs that she had brought. Sometime after arriving, John had put her up in a hotel and then he paid for her room, but she never checked out and her or her dogs were never seen again.
Yeah, it was crazy because he kept telling her that she was going to travel the world and that the hotel was just a temporary thing, but the date kept getting moved back. He never followed through with what he said he would do. But again, this is her master, essentially, so she can't really do anything about it. She just has to put up with it. That whole time, her parents were getting more and more upset, telling her this is a bad idea. But so she got herself locked into this, I think. By the time she realized just how dangerous it was too late. Suzette Troughton disappears sometime around February of 2000.
Around the same time, he meets a woman named Jean, who is a professional from the Southwest. She had been recently divorced. When she met John, he actually identifies himself as one of his aliases as James Turner. She was into the BDSM lifestyle. So they talk on the phone and they try to get to know each other. And he eventually invites her to come to Kansas. So she comes out for the weekend. And this is in April of 2000. So they meet up at a hotel where they start to engage in various kinds of bondage and BDSM. He's trying to get her to move to Kansas because he wants to spend more time with her. So towards the end of this little weekend romp, he wanted her to work for his company called HydroGrow, just another fabricated shell company that he's made up. She comes back in mid-May, and he puts her up at a hotel in Lenexa. He's being very domineering towards her, which if this is a dom-submissive relationship, this is nothing out of the ordinary. She complies, but he grabs her by the hair and flings her across the floor and starts beating her. He insists that she poses for photographs, which I'm sure he's just going to be using against her later, and telling her that he's punishing her. But this pretty much turns into a sexual assault.
And he also threatens her and says if she doesn't comply better, that she's going to have to move back home. But she's made a major life change here. I mean, she's moved to Kansas for this guy. And now, even though she's supposed to be submissive, this attack where he's beating her, I think she knows this is not good. She knows there's something really wrong with this.
After he leaves, she runs down to the front desk and reports this to the receptionist, who then in turn calls the police. She says the man that did this was James Turner, because that's all she knows about him. But the room is rented to John Robinson. This is very reminiscent of another attack that happened back in 1985. A woman named Teresa Williams, 21 years old, had been, I guess, dating John Robinson.
Yeah, he had been renting an apartment for her, and he told her she was his mistress.
He has the keys because, again, he has total control over his victims. And he barges into the room, and he grabs her by the hair, pulls her over his knees, and he starts spanking her and telling her that she's been a bad girl and that he's going to punish her. And then he pulls out a gun, puts it to her head, and pulls the trigger. But the gun is unloaded. Then he jabs the gun between her legs, threatens her some more. It's just beatings. It's just intimidation. There's nothing really sexual about this anymore. He's crossed a line.
John Robinson has been using violence to dominate people for a while. We didn't really bring it up until more recently on the episode because kind of set up where most people who knew him knew he was kind of a dominating personality. They knew he was a scammer, but they didn't know to what extent that his crimes would go. It's just now when people are disappearing that people are getting this idea that, wait a minute, this guy might be a killer.
I don't even know if they've gone that far. Law enforcement just knows that people have disappeared. People have reported bad things about this guy. They know he's a POS, but they don't know to what extent. And it's one of those hard things. Whenever law enforcement is investigating somebody, I mean, they can be a con artist, they can have a rap sheet, but I don't think they ever go into it thinking this person's a serial killer and they're making people disappear.
The police, the FBI, and the Secret Service were aware that John Robinson was not a good guy. Each of them had either investigated him or had active investigations going in around the summer of 99. These different agencies were really starting to move, really starting to focus on John Robinson. John Robinson, who's been writing letters for these missing people here and there, was starting to get sloppy. You know how it is. You get so sure of yourself. You're like, I don't even have to put that much effort into it because everything's working out for me. He'd never been arrested for anybody who disappeared. He's only been arrested for these scams that he's been pulling. But John Robinson is arrested on June 2nd, 2000, after two women come forward. And one woman complained to the police that she had been beaten and sexually assaulted by John Robinson. But another woman says, he stole my sex toys, which were, I think they were valued at what, hundreds and hundreds of dollars?
Yeah, it's still theft.
But that's really the key, isn't it? They use that theft charge against him. It's probable cause, right?
Yeah.
So they can search his property?
Exactly. They get search warrants. And you would think, well, wow, you know, an assault and stealing sex toys, does that merit a search warrant? Well, thank God they got one, because they go knocking on John's door.
Yeah. They go to his farm in Kansas, and they bring cadaver dogs with them, and they find two 85-pound chemical drums. What do they find, Justin?
They find the decaying bodies of two victims. And I think it's very telling that they brought cadaver dogs for a theft warrant. That really shows that they knew something was up here.
What did you say earlier? If something happens, report it. Because even if they don't do anything then, you're creating a paper trail. There's all these different reports coming in about a certain individual, and they can use that later. Well, I think this is where it all came to bear.
Yeah. As soon as they find these bodies on his land, they find other properties of his, and they find a storage unit that he rents out, and they get a search warrant for that also, where they end up finding more barrels and more bodies.
In total, they find five bodies. They do testing. They're able to discern who these women were. The victims were Isabella Lewicka, Suzette Troughton. They were found in Kansas, and in Raymore, Missouri, in those storage units, they found the bodies of Beverly Bonner, Sheila Faith, and Debbie Faith. Beverly Bonner was the woman who had left her husband for him. He had met her in the prison. And then Sheila Faith and her daughter, Debbie Faith. Debbie was the disabled daughter. And all of these women had something in common, the manner in which they were killed.
The other thing about this is the police were hoping that this was Paula Godfrey and Lisa Stacy. Those cases were still open, and they were surprised when they found these bodies that it wasn't them. And then they thought, well, who are these people? Because they had it in their head that, okay, we're gonna be able to close these other cases. And then they just open up a whole other barrel of bodies, and they have to identify them and go through the steps and motions. These bodies are badly decayed, but they're still able to do autopsies on them. And they find that all of them have been beaten to death, mainly with a hammer or a ball peen hammer. At this point, I'm looking at this guy. He's upstanding in his community, but he's messing with his neighbors. So that's very Dennis Rader-y to me. Also, he's a total con man, which I think you pointed out, Aaron, that this sounds like H.H. Holmes. Meanwhile, he's a scoutmaster and is very involved with his community. That's very John Wayne Gacy. So we have like H.H. Holmes, Dennis Rader, and Gacy all in one here.
The other thing about these victims that they found and identified, yes, they were killed by a hammer to the head, essentially. But none of them appeared to have had any kind of defensive wounds that they could tell. So they believe that he attacked them when they weren't aware that he was going to attack them, or when they were asleep. So in 2002, he heads to trial. They said that, at least at this point, it was the longest criminal trial in Kansas history. And I believe it, because when we read about this case, we didn't even list all of the different relationships he was in, all of the women that he attacked. I mean, this guy has an extensive criminal history. He was charged with and then found guilty. And this was not a surprise because, again, they had so many things pinned on him that there was no way he was getting out of this. He was found guilty of 3 counts of murder for the deaths of Suzette Troughton, Isabella Lewicka, and Lisa Stacy, interfering with parental custody for the kidnapping of Tiffany Stacy, a.k.a. Heather Robinson, and theft. All told, he received two death sentences, one count of life imprisonment because Lisa was killed before Kansas reinstated the death penalty, 20 and a half years for the kidnapping, and 7 months for the theft. After Kansas got done with him, Robinson was charged with more murder charges in Missouri. And in a contrast to Kansas, Missouri was much more aggressive with its death penalty cases. In order to reach a plea deal and eliminate the possibility of a death sentence, Missouri prosecutors insisted that Robinson lead them to Lisa Stacy, Paula Godfrey, and Catherine Clampett's bodies because they didn't know where they were. And of course, Robinson never told anybody the truth about what happened to them.
I understand that families want to have closure. I understand that families want to know what happened to their loved ones. But personally, I feel that prosecutors will make these plea deals like, tell us where the bodies are and you won't get the death penalty. I can only hope that all of the families, all of the surviving victims were on board with this plea deal and that it wasn't just made willy-nilly by a prosecutor, because I think some of the families, they know that their loved one is gone and they just want to see this man go away. So I'm sort of on the fence here on these plea deals about lead us to the bodies and you'll avoid the death penalty.
Like most serial killers, he doesn't want to give up this kind of information. So he turned the deal down. He doesn't want to do it.
Oh, and did we mention that he pleaded not guilty to all these charges?
Well, of course. I mean, John Robinson's ego would not let him plead guilty to all these murder charges, right? Especially when, in the case of three of these women, they don't even have their bodies.
Yeah, but they find multiple bodies on his property, yet, no, I'm not guilty. You don't have anything on me. It's just the arrogance, the narcissism.
Yeah, there's that. But also, unlike his scams that landed him in prison and in jail, this is life sentence here, or worse, it's death penalty. So he's just not going down without a fight. In the end, a deal is struck because in October of 2003, John Robinson admitted that Missouri had enough evidence to convict him in the deaths of Paula, Catherine, Beverly, Sheila, and Debbie. And according to the state of Missouri, this was a guilty plea. And of course, Robinson can sort of say it wasn't really, but as far as I can tell, it seems like one. And I think for the general public, yeah, he's a killer. Robinson received two more sentences of life without the possibility of parole. So he had gotten sentences for all five murders. Nancy Robinson, his wife, filed for divorce in 2005. So I don't know what took her that long. I'm not sure what's going on there, but I have to think that she was in fear of this man. And it wasn't until he got put away that she started to pick herself up and move forward. In 2002, Heather Robinson, who was actually Tiffany Lynn Stacy, learned about her real past. I mean, she grew up with Don and Helen Robinson. Those were her parents. But imagine finding out, and this was in the early 2000s, I think by 2002 she had discovered this, she was actually Tiffany Lynn Stacy. Her mother was murdered by John Robinson, and then he sold her illegally to who became her parents, his brother and his sister-in-law. She said this was devastating. Some of her friends left her. She had the media hounding her. She suffered all kinds of mental health issues from this because her whole world turned upside down. She ended up talking to her biological dad, Carl Stacy. This must have been a very difficult call. And I know it was for Carl because he said that when he talked to her on the phone that she put blame on him as well for what happened because he reenlisted in the Navy and he left his wife and young daughter behind. He, of course, blames a lot of other people. He blames John Robinson. He blames the state. He blames a lot of people, saying if things were handled correctly, then maybe he would have had a chance to patch things up and turn things around. But he didn't get that chance because John Robinson was able to take Lisa away and no one really followed up on it, not to his satisfaction. Heather Robinson was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, post-traumatic syndrome disorder, and depression. Her life's just never going to be the same. The one little glimmer of light here in all of this is that she still loves her parents, Don and Helen, and they still love her. And in fact, after they found out that she was actually a victim in all of this and that they had been scammed, they went through the process of adopting her legally, and they were successful. So that's their daughter.
In November 2015, John Robinson had filed a huge appeal in Kansas for his death sentence. The opinion was over 400 pages. He had claims from double jeopardy to improper use of warrants, just all kinds of things. Like, his lawyer just went through every single charge, every single thing used against him, and filed pretty much a motion to have it all thrown out. The courts did throw out one of his capital murder convictions, as well as a first degree murder conviction. They found that they were using each one for a capital murder charge, which they considered double jeopardy. It's kind of a weird legal twist there. Even though they've dismissed some of these charges, he still has multiple murder charges.
In November of 2015, the convictions for Suzette and Lisa's murders were vacated. And this was because of technicality. So the law is just trying to do the right thing legally. But the good news is the conviction for the murder of Isabella Luica stood. And Robinson still resides on death row in Kansas, although they're not really putting people to death over there. I mean, they brought it back, but they're not really utilizing it.
He'll be there forever. Were you paying attention, Aaron, when this hit the news? Do you remember when this story broke?
Absolutely not.
It was on every single TV. And the disgusting thing about it was you heard about a man called Slave Master who had bodies found on his property. And then you heard about all of his victims, including ones that survived. And yet, at this time, BDSM was not popular in mainstream media. The women that had come out against him, a lot of the comments and viewpoints were, they signed a contract and they consented to him. So that's not really sexual assault. Consent can be withdrawn at any time. And he obviously crossed a line with a lot of them. All of them had pretty much complained to the police, reported sexual battery. The attitude was, well, that's what you get when you're hanging out in that kind of a group and when you sign a contract with somebody. As more and more details came out, I think it became pretty evident that this guy was a serial killer. He was the actual perpetrator of all these crimes, and I guess the sexual assaults and whatnot fell to the wayside. People didn't care about those anymore because we had a serial killer amongst us now. But it really shows the point of view on sexual assault and what he could get away with, and how even the public at the time was very dismissive of a lot of the women that filed complaints against him.
And we've seen that over time. I won't name names, but we've seen it in politics. We've seen it in Hollywood, where people will be dismissive of some people's accusations because they'll say, yeah, but look who's saying it. It's like there's this idea that these people don't have a right to report a crime because of who they are.
Or they went back to the apartment, they were drinking. What did they expect to happen? As if we're somehow expected to be attacked or assaulted. It's just incredible to me to see some of the viewpoints and attitudes out there. And I remember when this hit the news, and that was a predominant viewpoint of, well, these women were in an S&M scene and were submissive to him, but now they're going to complain that he beat them too hard or something. And it's like, oh, it just blows my mind and makes me cringe sometimes.
Now, because he'd messed up so many people's lives with his scams, his assaults, his murders, and there were people he forged their names on documents, they had to come out and talk about. That wasn't my signature. Just on down the line, people missing, people trying to report it to the police getting letters saying, no, I'm fine. I'm just, I don't want to be around my parents or what have you. This really is the kind of case that you can't get any satisfaction from. And I think we see that also with the lawsuits that were filed. You had a lot of people blaming other people. The nurse who referred Lisa Stacy to John Robinson, she was involved in a lawsuit. Truman Medical Center was involved in a lawsuit. You also had Heather Robinson filing a lawsuit against John Robinson. And this is one that I think needed to happen. If you think about it, John Robinson had pulled so many scams. As I said earlier, someone had said that no scam was too small for him. Now that he's in prison and he's got no hope of getting out, maybe no hope of living. I mean, we'll see what happens with his death penalty. But Heather, his daughter, really wanted to make sure that he couldn't profit from his crimes. Because what if he decides, oh, I want to make some money. I could write a book on this. I bet there'd be all kinds of publishing companies lining up, or even studios lining up to pay me money so that I can tell my story or be involved. And Heather made sure that wasn't going to happen. She filed a lawsuit, and it was the judgment of the court for $5 billion. Now, of course, John doesn't have that much, but if he were to profit at all, then that money would go straight out to her. And it was just her way of protecting herself and making sure that he couldn't benefit, which I think is a great thing. And someone like Heather, who's been through as much as she has, you have to find that silver lining. And between really staying with her parents and keeping that relationship going,
I just sad that she had to do that. It's sad that she had to think one step ahead of him and realize that he could make money off of his heinous crimes. And she's anticipating that and showing him, you can't do anything. We have the power now.
It seems that everyone got together and finally saw John Robinson for what he really was. Smarmy, conniving, weaselly, controlling, dominant. This guy is one of the worst scumbags that I've ever read about. And when we had people sending in suggestions saying, you have to cover John Robinson, he's one of the worst, I had briefly read about him and thought, this doesn't seem, you know, in the realm of things, it doesn't sound as bad as Berdella. You know, Berdella was capturing men and literally torturing them. Trust me, this guy hits so many different people in different ways that he was truly a monster. He affected so many lives in and around the Kansas City area and beyond that I just don't know, unless you actually do all the reading or if you just take our word for it, he had a big impact and a very negative one at that.
This episode could have been two or three parts easily. We tried to combine it and compact it the best we could. But this guy really, the fact that he was preying on single mothers and women in need, he preyed on the weak that were seeking help. And that's what really sets him apart from a lot of other people and a lot of other serial killers, is he set up organizations and shell companies to draw these people to him with the hopes that they could live a better life and get help. Those were his victims. He had to pull his cons on people that were seeking help, and he had to work his evil on other people's goodness, faith in humanity.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.